All right. Well, this is Cliff Kellogg from the Department of Treasury, and I'm here with several of my colleagues, Terry and Paul, who also participated on our webinar last Monday, and also my colleagues Phyllis and Maureen, Phyllis, who does a lot of the outreach management work, and Maureen, who's our new head of monitoring and compliance. Before I start, why don't I just go down and mention the states and the District of Columbia that I heard were on the call, so that if I missed anyone, you can call out. I have, this is just in no particular order, Arkansas, District of Columbia, Louisiana, Utah, Michigan, Nebraska, New Hampshire, Florida, California, Massachusetts, Minnesota, South Dakota, Oregon, New Mexico, Maryland, State of Washington, South Carolina, and Tony, I had you from Tony Johnson from North Carolina. Did I miss any other states?
Texas.
Alabama.
Yes.
Rhode Island.
Ohio.
Nevada.
Mississippi.
Colorado.
Excellent. Thank you very much for joining today. As a reminder at the top of the call, just a couple of technical notes. If you would kindly mute your own call until we get to the Q&A section, that would assure the best clarity on everyone's speaker. And secondly, I want to mention to you that we are recording this conference call so that we can post it on our website. This is the first conference call that we've held. Today's subject deals with capital access programs, and we will have a second phone call this Thursday at the same time to discuss other credit support programs. Many of you may also have watched the webinar that the Treasury Department sponsored last Monday. In the event you missed that webinar, it is available on our website, and that web address is www.treasury.gov/SSBCI for State Small Business Credit Initiative. Again, that web address is treasury.gov/SSBCI. As I said, the purpose of our call today is to discuss capital access programs, and I thought that a very effective way to start would be to ask Tony Johnson of the Rural Center in North Carolina to talk about their capital access program. In North Carolina, there had been a capital access program for more than a decade, and then that program ended its funding a couple of years ago until this new federal funding in the SSBCI program allowed them to relaunch that program. And Tony and his team, his colleagues, have just finished a very extensive series of rollout meetings around the state. I believe it's more than 11 meetings, including a number of those that were attended by the governor of North Carolina. So North Carolina, I think, has really really been working hard to launch this program and to put the funds to good use and see some more small business lending. So I asked Tony prior to this call if he would be so kind as to share the documents that he's using for the North Carolina CAP program. Those documents are working drafts, please understand that, and they were emailed to you yesterday afternoon. Tony, I'm going to hand it over to you in just a minute to walk us through a description of your program. Maybe if you would be willing to spend up to 10 minutes or so just describing the program and your outreach. And then, Tony, if you'd be willing to take Q&A from various folks on this call, I think that would be the maybe one of the most valuable things we could do. Treasury did receive, prior to this call, we received a few emailed questions, and we have we could take those if we don't get enough Q&A on this call. So we will we'll follow that agenda. Tony first, and some Q&A for Tony, and then at the end we'll touch on the other questions that have been emailed to us. Our goal is to conclude the call about 2 o'clock in 1 hour. So, Tony, are you there?
I am. Okay. Thank you, Cliff. Just so, you know, I do have a North Carolina accent, and I do have a cold, so hopefully everybody can understand me. If you know, if you don't, just write down your questions, and I'll try to get to those later. Just to start off, the Rural Center is a private nonprofit that was formed to increase the economic vitality of the rural center and rural counties of North Carolina. We serve, North Carolina has about 100 counties, and our primary mission is to work with 85 of those counties. The primarily what the Rural Center does is in the area of water and sewer grants. We also have an economic, a business development division, and that's what I head up. The Rural Center, the only program that we have that is statewide is the Capital Access Program. And as Cliff mentioned, we ran that program from 1994 to 2008. We never had a lot of money to put into it. It was initially funded with $1 million from the North Carolina General Assembly, and then there was later funding from our tobacco settlement organization, the Appalachian Region Commission, and the SBA. Over the 13-14 years we operated the program, we put about $3.6 million into it. But with that $3.6 million, we enrolled over $103 million worth of loans, and that was about 1,850 loans, an average loan of about $60,000. That, you know, we quit enrolling loans in 2007 because of lack of funding, and so we were really excited about getting the allocation from Treasury through the Small Business Jobs Act. We started actually planning of how we were going to use the money back last fall. The governor and several other representatives from organizations around the state, you know, actually decided to put all of our money into CAP. So right now, our allocation of the $46 million is all going to CAP, at least at the beginning. We started planning our rollout sessions, and our rollout sessions, are having them all across the state. We started in Charlotte, which is our largest banking center, and it was opened by the governor. We've had either the Secretary of Commerce or the Assistant Secretary at each session. We've had either our Small Business Commissioner or Assistant Small Business Commissioner at each session. And we've also had a bank that participated in the program last time, and also a borrower that actually got a loan from the program each time. So at each session, we give an overall message about what CAP is all about and how these new funds are going to be able to allow us to expand the program statewide and to every bank that wants to participate in the program. With our earlier program, we had about 24 banks that participated and about 10 banks that participated heavily. In North Carolina, we have about 130 different banks, so their participation was fairly small. We had about 2 banks that participated very heavily, and they were 2 of our largest banks in the state, but then the community banks were the next largest participant. This time we are targeting, because we're devoting all of our money to CAP, we're targeting all 130 banks, and we're also targeting the about 10 credit unions that do small business lending, and also between 5 and 10 CDFIs that also do small business lending. At the rollout sessions, we've actually targeted several groups. The first group we've targeted are the small business assistance providers. In North Carolina, we have both the small business development centers, which we call small business technology development centers. We have the small business centers that are each community college. We have SCORE. Those are the three major assistance providers. So we're getting the representatives from all of those organizations at each meeting. We're also targeting the chambers, economic developers, and those other people who will be in contact with small business owners and in contact with banks. We're also targeting banks and other lenders such as credit unions and CDFIs, and we're targeting some small business owners that can help get the word out. After the initial session, the initial session is about 45 minutes to an hour. When that is completed, I have a special session just for bankers, to where I go over the actual, the participation agreement, all the enrollment forms, the claim forms, and I do that through a program manual. And I think everyone got a copy of the program manual. And the program manual, we've got the quick reference guide, which is the first three pages, and that's primarily what I go over with the bankers. I'll go over the quick reference guide and also all the forms, the enrollment forms, and the claim forms, and the notice to borrower. And so far, it's been working really well. North Carolina is a fairly large state, and the way we're going to, and I'm going to go ahead and go into some of the questions that was asked about the staff resources and workload. Because we're devoting all the funds to CAP, we're going to be hiring two people two associate directors that are going to help with the program, and I'm also going to continue working with the program part time. So we're going to have three staff members that are just working with the banks and training the bankers as we go along. We're also going to have one admin person her time is totally devoted to the program. Of course, during these rollout sessions, we have had a large number of we've had a lot of staff resources devoted to the program because we've had a caravan really going over the entire state. But the response to our rollout sessions has been great. We've gotten good press in a lot of the papers. The banks are excited about it. And so far, it seems to be working very well. I'll end with one success story. A couple weeks ago, we had a session in Hickory. And we had some bankers there. And on the way back from that session in Hickory, North Carolina, one of the bankers called me and told me he wanted to go ahead and sign the participation agreement and go ahead and roll the first loan. So, in fact, I got the participation agreement the next week, and he also enrolled the first loan the next week. So, and that's been a good success story since that time. So far, we've gotten enrollment forms from four banks, and there's about 20 that are in the process of getting them to us right now. So we hope to have somewhere between 25 and 30 banks enrolled by the end of next week or so. Let's see, that's about 10 minutes, Cliff.
That's great news. I didn't realize you had already had that many banks interested, but I did have the chance to attend one of those rollout sessions, and I can say there were probably at least 75 or 85 folks that were at that rollout session that I attended. And it sounds like your team has really figured out how to put together a program that appeals and do the right kind of outreach. Have there been any surprises, Tony? Any administrative challenges that you've had internally? And then I wonder if you could also say how you decided to focus on the CAP program exclusively.
Okay, administratively, we're basically just using the same format that we did last time, and we're hoping, we're still hoping that, you know, with Treasury's help, that we can develop some good processes and everything.
I'm sorry, the music I'm hearing might be because somebody has us on hold. I don't know.
Maybe.
Just be aware of that. Don't put us on hold. Put us on mute.
Okay. And what was the other question, Cliff? Yeah,
the question was, how did you decide to focus on CAP,
on CAP
exclusively?
Yes, the reason we decided to go totally on CAP was because the program was so successful last time. And the governor and her staff wanted to use the funds that we would have be able to have the most leverage with the money. And the CAP program, with the Rural Center running it last time, we had such good leverage. We had about 28.5-1 leverage. So the governor decided to put all the money into the CAP program. And she also consulted with our State Bankers Association and the Banking Commissioner, along with a number of other people.
And Tony, how do you get comfortable that there's enough incentive for banks to increase their lending that would not otherwise occur?
Cliff, I think I lost you.
Can you hear me okay, Tony?
I can now. Mm-hmm.
How do you get comfortable that there's enough incentive for banks to do new loans that they wouldn't do otherwise?
We do, because from what we're hearing from the bankers, for an example, the first loan that was enrolled, it was a loan that the bank had been considering. It was one of those loans that they really did not know whether they were going to make or not. But once the banker heard about the CAP program, he saw that as the perfect way to make this loan. And we're getting that from a number of the bankers, is that right now there's very little out there to help them make loans. And with the regulators and everything looking over their shoulders as much as they are, they need that little bit extra incentive to actually do the loans. And that's the reason we think that the CAP program is going to have a big effect on that.
Let's see, I'm just looking down my list of questions here. Tony, could you just talk for a minute about the kind of enrollment form that you use?
Good, yes. Yes, we are, I'd like to thank Paul Brown for this with the Michigan model. We're basically used the Michigan forms. And what we did is took the Michigan forms and adapted them for North Carolina, and then looked at all the guidelines that Treasury, issued, and instituted all those guidelines that were in there into the participation agreement and into the enrollment forms. So we're really basing all of ours on the Michigan model.
And did you require any new legislation or new authority for this?
No, that was one area where North Carolina was very lucky. When the legislation was passed in 1993 in North Carolina, in the legislation, it gave the Rural Center the authority to operate the Capital Access Program, and it really gave the Rural Center the authority to do everything it needed to do to run the Capital Access Program. Because of that, our program is very flexible. The Rural Center can make pretty much all the decisions about the Capital Access Program.
Mm-hmm. And can you just say a minute about what kind of regular reporting you get from the banks that are enrolled in the program?
We're going to go by what the guidance is in the that Treasury issued, and we're going to get the quarterly reports, and we have that in our participation agreement. We're getting all the information that Treasury asked for in the guidance. Then in the reporting, You know, we're asking for the, on a quarterly basis, the name of the borrower, the amount of the loan, the amount of the enrolled loan, whether the loan is a term loan or a line of credit, outstanding balance of the loan, and the delinquency aging. And what we're asking for is whether it's 30 to 59 days, 60 to 90 days, or 90 plus days, or non-accrual.
And what kind of feedback are you getting from banks on that reporting?
Very little at this time. I'm not sure what will happen in the future, but at this point, the banks are just telling us they're going to set up their books to be able to give us what we need.
And can you say how has the program been received by large banks and by small banks? What are the design features that appeal to them?
With the largest bank in North Carolina and is BB&T. And BB&T, I think BB&T has about 360 branches in North Carolina. And one of the good things about it was Kelly King, who was the who is the CEO of BB&T, was on our board for years. And Kelly King was also instrumental in getting the CAP program in North Carolina in the mid-90s. But BB&T is our largest bank, and they are, you know, of course, they're very excited about participating in a program. And I believe BB&T participates in the CAP program in just about every state that's in their footprint. Our second largest bank in North Carolina is First Citizens, and they were one of the first banks to sign up because they were very happy with the program last time. Then we have a lot of the other banks. The community banks are probably the most excited about participating in the program because it gives them another way to make those kind of loans they would be making. You know, gives them a way to better serve their customers in their local communities, because the decision making power is usually with the individual banker or with whoever that banker works for. But so far we're getting good feedback from pretty much everybody. Yesterday we had a good bank attendance in Asheville, North Carolina. I think we probably had about 20-some bankers at our session, and a number of them just walked up to me and just, you know, told me how excited they were about the program, how they're looking forward to participating in it. But on the other side, the biggest issue the bankers have about participating in the program is, you know, whether the demand is there and whether they can get the types of loans to enroll in the program. Because as it is across the United States, I'm sure, the balance sheets of so many of the borrowers have deteriorated over the last few years, even with the Capital Access Program. They're still not going to be able to enroll those loans. We still have that, you know, especially in some of the areas, and it's primarily in the rural areas where the asset values have gone down so much and there's not a lot of growth happening at this time. But in mostly the urban areas and the suburban areas around the urban areas, there is a lot of excitement.
Terry, do you see this program working better for smaller loans or larger loans or both? Tony, excuse me.
Yes, okay. We see it working for both. And the larger loans, you know, that's something – I'm not sure if anybody has experience with that middle market or not, but that middle market, I've been talking to a number of bankers about it. And I think what's going to happen is for those larger loans, they're going to be enrolling a portion of the loan as opposed to the whole loan, especially for some of the larger, owner-occupied real estate loans where the loan-to-value may be a little bit higher than what they would like to see. They could possibly enroll as much as 20% of the loan. But for the smaller loans, especially for the startup businesses, I think there's going to be a lot of those loans. Another area where I think we're going to have a lot of loans enrolled are lines of credit. one thing about a line of credit is that, you know, lines of credit usually are renewable on a yearly basis. So a line of credit is one way that a bank can enroll a loan because, you know, instead of not renewing a line of credit, they may be able to put it into this program and actually renew it where they might not otherwise be able to.
And, Tony, I've heard a question or two from folks who are banks that are just beginning to operate the program. And so at the beginning, their reserve fund is not yet accumulated very much. Have you had to answer that question? How do you answer that? Because our Treasury statute really limits the Treasury SSBCI money to be 1-to-1 matching the contribution from the borrower and the lender. So do you have any thoughts on how you handle that question?
Yes. The way we handle it is we have, and for those of you who look at our participation agreement, if you'll look at Exhibit 5, which is our last one, which is a special claim form, you know, in many of the participation agreements, if there's not enough money to pay a claim, then the bank can, or lender can just get the amount of funds that are in the reserve fund. And I'm not sure where this came from or whether other states use it or not, but if there is not enough money in the reserve fund, with Exhibit 5, the bank can take all of what's in the reserve fund at that time and then up to 75% of any additional funds that are put into the reserve fund until the claim has been paid. In other words, to give you an example, let's just say there's a $100,000 claim early in the program and there's only $50,000 in the reserve fund. The bank could actually take that $50,000 and then 75% of any additional funds that are put into the reserve fund until they're paid, until the claim is paid. For example, if they took out the complete 50, then they put an additional $10,000 in a reserve fund, they could take $7,500 of that out for this claim and leave $2,500 in and keep doing that until the claim was paid. This just gives the lender a little bit, especially those smaller lenders, they're not using the program as much. It gives them a chance to have their claim paid or if there is a loss early in the program.
So they, under your guidelines, then the bank can recover its loss sort of over time as new cap loans are enrolled and that account keeps hopefully getting larger. They can recover that loss that happened before some of these premiums were made.
That's correct.
That's state money sitting in this revolving fund.
What? Excuse me, did somebody else have a question? Well, I'd be glad to open the floor to everyone who's on the phone. If you have particular questions for Tony, and we're also fortunate that Paul Brown from Michigan is on the phone, and as you all know, Michigan also has a lot of experience with this program. So this is a chance to talk to folks who are really, really doing it.
I did not get Tony's complete name and the department in which he works in.
I work for the North Carolina Rural Economic Development Center. We are a private nonprofit that most of our funding comes from the state of North Carolina. But we are a private nonprofit, and so we are an independent organization. My title is I'm Senior Director of Business Development. I'm over all the business development programs at the Rural Center.
And your last name, Tony?
Johnson, J-O-H-N-S-O-N.
Thank you.
Tony, this is Dana Shepherd in D.C. Did you establish guidelines to either require or sort of or give banks an incentive to make loans to certain borrowers that they wouldn't ordinarily make? Was there some sort of requirements, or did you allow them to set those standards?
We made our program as flexible and as open as we can. So the banks have, the banks can pretty much decide, they have pretty much all the decision-making power. But we are targeting certain groups. We are working specifically with, for minority groups, we're working with the minority banks, the minority credit unions. And we're wanting to, and because we are the rural center, and the rural counties are the most underserved communities, we are targeting those rural communities too. But our program is statewide, and we are the banks, we're making this as much a bank program as possible, to where our primary role is just to match loan loss reserves and pay claims.
That's helpful, because one of the things that we're struggling with is, we're trying to avoid a situation where a borrower with a strong balance sheet and a 750 FICO score would ordinarily get a loan anyway from a particular bank, and we're trying to avoid a situation where that bank enrolls, that borrower takes advantage of the CAP program and not really extend itself beyond the type of loans that it would ordinarily make anyway without the CAP. And so we're trying to figure out a way to encourage them to go beyond their current underwriting requirements but without forcing them to make really bad loans.
What I'm hearing from the banks here in North Carolina is that borrowers are pretty much, especially those borrowers with good credit scores and a lot of collateral, they know that that's power in the marketplace. And if they can get a loan without having to pay the capital access fee, they're going to get that loan without having to pay the capital access fee. So in North Carolina, we believe the market is going to help keep those stronger borrowers from getting the cap loans, so where it's mostly those that are that are deficient in one of the underwriting areas that actually get the loans.
Thank you very much.
Tony, are you seeing that the banks are concerned about the high level of fees? You're looking at 3% from the borrower and what is it, 3% from the bank as well?
No, they can charge that much. The banks are concerned about the fees, and we've been working several different ways with that. We, the way the legislation is written, we're giving the bank we're letting the bank decide how they come up with the fees, how much the borrower pays and how much the bank pays. We're trying to give as much flexibility to the banks as we can under the guidelines.
Right.
And so the bank determines, what the borrower fee is going to be and what the fee the bank's going to pay. The bankers tell me it's hard to get fees out of a customer now.
Right.
One of the ways that the banks are doing it is they're what they're telling the borrower. But one of the reasons the borrowers do not like to pay fees is because they think the fee is going to the bank. Some of the banks have found out that as long as the borrower knows the fee is not going to the bank, but is going to the capital access fund,
right,
that they're not as reluctant to pay the fee. I mean, I'm not sure if it makes sense or not, but it seems to be working. That the bank just regularly says, we can give you this loan if we enroll it into the capital access program. And when you enroll in the capital access program, you're going to have to pay this 3% fee. And it doesn't go to us. It goes to the capital access program. And that has worked for some of the banks. Even though the banks can be the one benefiting from the fee, it's not a bank fee. It's a capital access program fee.
That's a great point. If I can add a follow-up question, are the banks passing on their fee to the borrower, or are the
banks? They are.
Okay, so if the borrower is paying 3, is that then becomes 6%? Or
no, it's basically the way it is the borrower is just paying the 3%.
Okay, and that's all the fees that?
That's all the fee.
Okay.
And we match that.
a 3%. So the 6% becomes the initial pool for that particular loan.
That's right. But see, some banks do it different ways. One bank has told me they haven't enrolled in loans yet, but one bank told me they were just going to put 2% into the origination fee for cap loans.
Right.
And just have it as the origination fee that way to where, but different banks are going to do it different ways. But we have taken a hands-off approach in working with the banks and let them make the decisions about that, of how they can best market the program.
And maybe one last question, and I'm trying to understand why the banks would consider this credit enhancement sufficient enough to make a loan to a business that they would not ordinarily make it to, or not in a conventional manner, mm-hmm. when the guarantee, if I understand it correctly, and I'm still learning this process, initially is only, let's say, 6%, when they can do an SBA Community Express or some other credit enhancement that provides a larger guarantee, a larger credit enhancement. What makes the banks excited about 6% or 10% or whatever the percentage is? It seems relatively low for a loan that might have some hair on it.
Well, those with the ones that are getting put into the Capital Access Program are not those that have a whole lot of hair on them.
Okay.
It's just those, and what they're underwriting for is they're underwriting for in our program they try to underwrite for a 5% loss rate. Banks usually do not underwrite for a 5% loss rate. Banks underwrite for a 1 to 2% loss rate. So if banks had a 5% loss, over the last few years, many of them have had 5% losses, but traditionally they do not like that high loss rate. But with this program, they can write to and expect a 5% loss rate and be okay.
Okay.
But to give you an example, what most of the banks look for is they look, to loan to value. They look at that. They look at cash flow coverage. They look at collateral. There's a lot of different things they look at. In this program, like the first loan that was enrolled, where the hair was the cash flow coverage. The loan that was rolled only had a little bit over a 1 cash flow coverage, where the bank liked to do a 1.25 cash flow coverage.
Right.
But everything else looked really good. It was just that cash flow coverage was where the hair was on this loan.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Tony, this is Brenda with Louisiana.
Yeah.
And I'm not. I mentioned earlier, everybody's not at Mardi Gras, but we've got some very good questions we need to ask to get our program started. One of the things that we are looking at is that we currently have a cap access program on the books that we have had for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get the enrollment of our banking community in the state has been a little bit, has not been there, especially when we had the program in 97. And I guess it's maybe because we have a statewide loan guarantee and participation program similar to the SBA's guarantee programs. When trying to get the banking community interested in revitalizing and using these funds for the CAP Access program, we run into a lot of resistance. And what we're looking at, my question today is there a way we can make the CAP Access program attractive to the banking community in light of all of them having used in the past our guarantee programs, which, as the caller before me mentioned about the giving the banks better guarantee coverage.
In North Carolina, North Carolina has got some. We've got some very. North Carolina's always had very good banks. Of course, we have, and one of the. I think the best thing to say is we've had some very innovative banks in North Carolina, and the bankers compete quite heavily in North Carolina. And with having some of the banks that since we had the two largest banks by number of branches participate, and like Kelly King, CEO of BB&T, he would actually call other banks and try to get them to participate in the program. And I think that's one way, and that's one thing we're going to use a lot this time, too, in getting all of our banks to participate, is we've had several of the some of the larger banks say they'd be glad to try to get to help us get the other banks participating. And sometimes when the facts don't always work, hearing it from another banker that they respect does work.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you may need to find, my suggestion would be try to find some champions in the banking world that would be able to help you sell the story when the facts of how good the program work do not sell the story.
Right. Thanks.
I have a question. Can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you.
This is Helen Mirza at the Federal Reserve Bank in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
I apologize for being this question may be too fundamental, and if so, I just pass it by, because I'm filling in for someone else, actually. But it's a two-part question. One is one of the reasons the banks are so enthusiastic in North Carolina, is there a CRA credit for it?
We have told them that this should help in their CRA efforts.
Okay. Depending, of course, I presume, upon the borrower and the location where the funds are utilized, right?
And a lot of the loans that are going to be made under the CAP program in North Carolina are going to be to underserved communities.
Second part of – sorry, go ahead.
No, that's okay. Go ahead.
Well, I apologize for not having had a chance to read the underlying documents that the rest are familiar with, but – perhaps I'm getting the wrong impression. I'm getting the impression that this source of guarantee is exclusively the 6% fee charged to the borrower and the banker.
No, the way it works is for example, this is the example I use with the banks. They make $100,000. The fee collected, by the bank from the bank and the borrower is 3%. We match that 3%, so there's $6,000 goes into a reserve fund off that $100,000 loan. Okay,
and your money comes from the state, right?
No, our money comes from from what the Treasury allocation is from the state Small Business Credit Initiative. Now, let's expand that. Let's say that $5 million in loans are enrolled in the program. If the average fee collected was 3% and the match was 3%, that would mean there was $300,000 in that reserve fund to be used for any charge-offs. And we also allow for up to 3 months accrued interest and up to one-half of the collection cost. So the bank or the lender has that $300,000 on that $5 million in loans enrolled to use however they want to use that $300,000, as long as it's just for charge-offs, up to 3 months accrued interest, and half the collection cost. So if the bank or the lender manages that reserve fund correctly, then they and if they've done their underwriting such to that 5% loss rate, then they should be well covered. Go ahead.
They could be covered up to 6% of their losses, qualifying losses.
No, they'd be covered to 100% of their losses.
Excuse me, can I ask you a question? They're really only covered to 80% of their losses, right, because of the 20% risk sharing?
No, that's the 20% of their capital at risk, which means that they – now, Cliff, you can correct me here, but the way we read that is that 20% means that they have 20% of their capital at risk. It doesn't mean they cannot collect for 100% of the loss on the on any charge-offs.
That's the way we're interpreting it, Tony. You're correct.
Mm-hmm.
So they can recover all of their losses up to the extent of the amount that's in that reserve fund. And then Tony said that in North Carolina, if the losses are greater than the amount in the reserve fund, they can continue to collect from future deposits into that reserve fund, 75% of it, of those future deposits.
Well, I guess that was the question I was ultimately leading to is, it seems kind of like as time goes on, if there are unanticipated large losses, more and more banks would be reluctant to kick in because it's going to be sucked up by existing losses.
That's true, but those are not the kind. But see, at least all the loan officers that I've worked with here in North Carolina, they're a pretty cynical group, and they're not going to make those kinds of loans. They're not going to make those high risk loans. They're just going to make those loans that are on the edge of what they can do. If they are making a higher risk loan, they'll probably enroll it into an SBA guaranteed program.
Right.
Okay, but I'm just saying. If losses exceed, I mean, and that's the game with all lending, of course, mm-hmm. is that losses can exceed expectations. So since those losses are eating into the next fees paid in, it seems like, A, there's a big advantage to being first in, because first in, first out, and the last in would be last out. So would a lender not be to come in at the tail end of a program without looking at what the losses, accumulated losses are?
One thing we should clarify, I think, is that each bank keeps a separate reserve fund.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no commingling. The bank is has the assurance that the loans in its portfolio that are enrolled in CAP, those are the only ones that can offset this reserve fund. Each bank holds its own.
And the other thing I'll add to that is the FDIC, at least here in North Carolina, because and we've had a number of banks be taken over the last couple years, is that all the banks are pretty much running scared from the FDIC, so they're very careful about the types of loans they're making. But this program allows them to make those loans they wouldn't otherwise make because they're getting the reserve fee match. And, you know,
okay, I just want to make sure I understand this. So if a bank makes a $100,000 loan and there's $6,000,
yes.
In there, and they have losses on that loan, that one loan, exceeding $6,000, the only way they can recoup more of their loss is if they make additional loans and additional loss reserves are put up or fees are put up. Not if other lenders put up.
That's true, but this is not a program where you enroll one loan. This is a program where the lender needs to enroll multiple loans to make the program work for them.
What do they think as far as, like, is there an optimal number of loans that they feel give at a 6% loss?
I've been telling lenders that you need to make at least 15 to 20 loans before this program starts making sense and putting into the program. Because if you're charging a 6% fee, then if you have a total loss on one loan and you've enrolled 15 loans, you're going to be made whole. You're going to be fine. But there's very few loans that will be made with 100% loss because whenever a lender makes a loan, I mean, they look at the collateral. They look at all these different underwriting standards or underwriting issues before they make the loan. So, you know, a lot of them have already tell themselves, you know, our possibility of a loss on this loan may be 15 to 20% if everything goes bad. And by having that 6% reserve and with enough of those loans in there, they should be fine.
Tony, this is Perian from California.
Hello.
Hi. I wanted to clarify something with you and or maybe Treasury. I think I heard you say that the borrower can cover the lender's portion or what I consider the lender's portion of the fee. In other words, the borrower could pay all of the fee associated with the loan, with the lender paying none of the fee. Is that right? And from Treasury, is that allowable from your perspective?
Well, I'm glad you clarified that, Mike. I made a note to myself on this. The statute says that the Treasury money that is in the state's hands to administer, that that can match the contribution that comes from the lender and the borrower. So according to our lawyers, the strict reading of that is that both the bank and the lender must make some contribution. Now, Treasury will not look through and ask, where does the lender's contribution come from? Or the borrower's contribution will not look through to that and say, where does that come from? But in terms of the precise structure of the transaction, the statute requires that the Treasury money match a contribution that comes, and it specifically says borrower and lender. So the bank and the lender can organize themselves how they would like to get that money and where it comes from.
Yes, this is Natalie Burley with the state of Ohio, and my understanding is most of the CAP programs operate such that the borrower does, that the bank can pass their match on to the borrower. And that's the reason why when I sent my question as what kind of documentation will you look for, because, on our documentation, the bank is matching the borrower, but, we know that they require a lot of master borrowers to pay their match.
Right. We don't require that the bank match the borrower. It's only that that they each have some contribution, and that combined contribution is between 2% and 7%. And then whatever that combination is, Treasury can match that 1-to-1. If the state, using its own funds, the state may choose to add more as a match, but that would anything above a 1-to-1 match, that would come from other sources, not the Treasury money.
Hi, this is Gary Smith from Delaware. So if I understand correctly, that so long, because our program's like Ohio's program where, it's all the borrower's contribution, that so long as the combined bank and borrower's combination is 2%, you don't care what that ratio is, that we're okay. Or does it strictly have to be
the amount?
As I thought in the documents, it said that each party had to be, that the borrower and the bank both had to be equal participants. The borrower did 2%, then the bank had to do 2%. The borrower did 3%, the bank had to do 3%.
For the Treasury, I'm glad you're asking these questions for clarification. For the Treasury requirements, it's only that the combination has to be between 2 and 7. And there's no specified ratio between the amount the borrower contributes and the amount the lender contributes. It's only that, as a matter of form, there must be a contribution that comes from the borrower and from the lender. And so that could, for example, the borrower could come to the closing with two checks, one that's payable to the reserve fund and one that's payable to the bank. And then the bank would use that portion to put the lender contribution into the reserve fund.
Right, because we were thinking that we were going to have to, because the banks weren't, have told us that they weren't going to contribute their portion. So we were looking at the state making up the bank's portion.
Right. So that's not necessary. You could do that with your own state funds, but the federal funds match the combination of what comes from the lender and the borrower. And I understand, of course, we all understand that's a little bit of form over substance, but that's the way the statute is written.
Okay.
This is Helen Mirza again. If the fee, let's say, and I don't know, maybe I'm just cynical because I've been an examiner, but if the banks know that they can pass the entire fee on to the borrower, my belief is most of them will. Let's say they charge a 4% fee. on a $100,000 loan, that would have to be factored into the interest rate and the APR, would it not? Making for a very high interest rate and APR, would it not?
I don't have a view on that one, Helen. I think that's a question for the accountants and the regulators.
Compared to not getting a loan, no, it's not high.
Well, you can say that about 300% from a payday lender, too, if you're going to get kicked out of your apartment. But I can
tell you from our perspective here in Ohio that the borrower, more than likely will finance that fee. And so yes, they're paying interest on that fee, but the interest is not it's not a payday lender type rate. There's still a market a demand.
What I would suggest, Helen, is that you consult the report that we compiled in 2001 that had the statistics on the 23 states that operated capital access programs. I think that might help give some context to how the program works and what the lending volume and losses have been. That would be helpful, I'm sure.
But, I mean, isn't this Treasury thing new? The current guidance, is that not a new thing?
The Treasury program was passed in September of 2010, last year, but the Treasury report that I'm referring to was done in 2001.
But what I'm saying is the standards, as far as the fee goes, are new from September of 2010. So I guess my question is, first of all, I didn't mean to imply that the rates would look at all like payday lender rates. I was just going to the reasoning behind them is that you're saying, if you really need a loan that bad, then you don't care that much what the rate is. I wasn't implying that it was as high. I guess what I was wondering is are they being examined to make sure that when they pass that fee along, that is factored into the interest rate and the APR? As somebody, and I think you were saying, Mr. Johnson,
Can I comment?
But could I finish my question first?
Sure.
Because, Mr. Johnson, I think you said that your attorneys opined that the bankers needed to be paying some of it. It was contemplated that they would be paying some of it. So is there an audit process for that? That was the end of my question.
Is that to you, Cliff?
I'm not
it's
sure.
It's to either you or Mr. Johnson.
Okay. With us, I mean, we have the right to look over the lender's, books on the loans, but we're leaving it basically up to the lenders to decide how the fee is charged.
So you're Mr. Johnson, right?
I am. Mm-hmm.
Okay. If your attorneys have opined, though, that that's a requirement on the part of the banks, do you not contemplate that as a problem, that you're not auditing for that or requiring that?
Helen, what I would suggest, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think you're asking good questions that are about bank regulations, and I'd be glad to put you in touch directly with Tony or talk to you offline. That'd be great.
Okay.
Thanks.
I have a question with regard to the leveraging. When we're talking about the other credit support programs and then mixing those in with the CAP programs to come up with the leverage over the 7-year period, when you're talking about the CAP leverage, are you including the state's contribution into the reserve account as part of the leverage?
No. Are you talking about the 28 to 28.5 to 1?
Well, actually, I think this is for Cliff.
Okay, I'm sorry.
For Cliff,
mm-hmm.
As to what Treasury is looking at
okay.
when they're
oh,
looking at the leverage.
Go ahead. I'm going to ask my colleague Paul to handle that.
Yeah, we've handled this in a pretty simple way. In calculating leverage, we say that the denominator...
Excuse me, can you speak up a little bit, please?
I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir. Thank
okay.
you.
In calculating leverage, it's a simple formulation. We say that the SSBCI funds are the denominator and cumulative lending is the numerator. And that's the way we calculate leverage.
Okay, can you break that down, please?
So if,
that sounded very nice.
So if you have $1 million allocated for simple purposes of simple arithmetic to your CAP program of SSBCI funds, and you over a period of 7 years, for example, generate $50 million in loans, the leverage is 50 to 1.
So it's the amount of the new loans that are made
under the program
divided by
the SSBCI funds.
Right.
Okay.
Right. But my question is, if when you're looking at both programs, both the other credit support programs, and because if you establish a other credit support program where you don't get that type of leverage, and so you need to combine it with the CAP to help you get that type of leverage, get that at least that 10 to 1 or 1 to 10 leverage. When you're looking at the CAP, what are you considering as part of the numerator?
Denominator.
Denominator.
So the numerator are all the new loans that are made from whatever private source. It's new private lending. So you can count not just the loans that are made on the day the transaction closes, but you can count other new loans to that same borrower that
mm-hmm.
come over time.
But it's strictly the SBCI funds, not the state's funds.
That's right. I think you got
okay.
it.
That's right.
Okay.
Can I ask a question about loan participation and selling the loans? Is that permitted?
I think we'd have to look at that in particular to make sure we understood it and didn't give you a false answer. But I don't think of any. I can't think of anything that's automatically a disqualifier on that.
That's a good question. Do other states with their CAP program allow the banks to sell their CAP loans?
Let me ask our friends either in Michigan or California, since those have been large CAP programs. Are you still on the phone?
Yes, this is Nancy Trombley with California. We've had situations where one financial institution has either merged with another or sold their loans as a result of closing. And as long as the new participating financial institution enrolls in the program, then the loans are still covered.
This is Paul Brown from Michigan. We have the exact same experience on institutions that have either moved their whole portfolio as because of closing or merger, but we do allow institutions to sell their loans. Obviously, we can't restrict that, but those loans that have left the institution no longer have access to the reserve account. So for one reason or another, if they did sell off a portion of their portfolio, the reserve account stays with the banking institution and doesn't go with the original loans.
Thanks, Paul.
Which that just allows the banks to make a calculation on value as they're calculating the purchase price of those loans.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
So this is Nancy in California again, and we've had situations where the loan loss reserve also went with the loans to the new institution, and that's how we allowed them to continue.
So both California and Michigan have operated their capital access programs for a number of years, and so I'm sure there have been some twists and turns that they've thought of that we haven't yet thought of here at Treasury. It's now just after 2 o'clock, 2:07. We're a little over. We do have another phone call scheduled for Thursday at this same time to talk about other credit support programs, and we will send out a reminder and also ask if you could email us questions ahead of time. Then we'll be sure to handle those as well. We did receive some email questions that came in that we didn't get to here today, and we will respond to those also.
Cliff, this is Helen again. Since I've dialed in a few minutes late, could you tell me, are you with Treasury, Cliff, and how do I contact you?
Absolutely. My phone number, I'm happy to share it with anyone, is 202-622-8917. And my email address is clifton.kellogg, that's C-L-I-F-T-O-N, dot Kellogg, K-E-L-L-O-G-G, at treasury.gov.
Okay, so clifton.kellogg at treasury.gov?
That's right. You got it.
Okay. Thank you very much. And you're the person you said I could call about, right?
That would be fine.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, everyone. If there's no other questions, burning questions, we'll speak with you again on Thursday. Thank you very much.